So my strategy has always been buy low, rehab them nicely, market the hell out of them. And then when it comes time to negotiate, I try to keep a little under my competition as far as the price per square foot. So nicer buildings at a little less money, and we've had a really good success rate.
What's going on, everybody? This is the Passive Wealth Strategy Show, the show that will teach you how to build wealth with real estate without buying yourself another job. As always, I am your host, Taylor Lode. I'm a real estate investor, and I focus on multifamily and self-storage investing. Today, we are joined by Adam Craig. Adam is the founding member of CLE Real Estate Group, a real estate investment company located just outside Cleveland, Ohio. He has an extensive background in real estate portfolio topping $11 million between residential and commercial real estate. Today, we're going to dig into how he pivoted from single family investing to non-residential commercial real estate investing and so much more. We're going to talk about his journey, why he made the switch, how he picked his new target asset class, and everything around making a change in your real estate investment life. Adam, thank you for joining us today. Can you tell us a little bit more about what asset classes specifically you're targeting today?
Hey, Taylor, thank you for having me again on your show. And today I'm targeting pretty much every asset class except residential. I have mostly office and retail in my portfolio, a little bit of warehouse, but I am interested in industrial, but a lot of the value add stuff that I look for is in the office and retail space right now.
Great. Making that pivot from single family investing to non-residential commercial, I'd love to walk through that whole process that you went through in probably realizing that, okay, it's time for me to get out of the single family world and find another home, if you will, in the real estate space. And then how you selected what you're going to go after, all the lessons that you had to learn along the way when getting into a new area of real estate investing. But could you walk us back to that day, that time, that feeling that you had when you realized, I want to get out of this single family investing model?
Yeah. So the good thing about real estate is there's so many avenues you can take. You don't actually know what your path is going to be, because back in 2013, bought my first single family home. I envisioned myself owning maybe 100 single family homes, buying some apartment buildings, and keep going down that route. So from about 2013 till 2019, I purchased roughly 70 single family homes. Maybe about 20 of them were flips and the rest of them were the BRRRR strategy. So I rehabbed them, refinanced them, held onto them as rentals. It wasn't until about 2019 when I really felt like I was hitting my stride. I had my second child and my home office went from a real peaceful place to work to just a madhouse. Even though it was in the basement, far away from the kids, going upstairs for lunch, bathroom breaks, kids slamming on the door, it was not efficient to say the least. So started looking around my area for a little office to rent and stumbled upon a building that was for sale right in the city I was born, but in a really nice downtown trendy area, kind of coffee shops and bars kind of scene. The building was a little bit roughed up. To make a long story short, ended up purchasing that building with it, the expectation that I was going to work out of it and lease out the rest. And at the time, I had never envisioned buying anything but residential. And it was an office building, and it was actually right before the pandemic. So I got in there, made myself at home, started rehabbing the place, and then the pandemic hit. We were still rehabbing the place for about 3 months after the pandemic, but it came up finished and it was time to lease. And I had no idea what was going to happen. Got my first leasing experience during a 100-year pandemic. I was offering things like pandemic release and anything I could to get someone in. I just wanted to assure people if lockdown happens again, you guys are out and you can get out and I'm not going to financially hold you responsible, because I was pretty nervous to get tenants at the time. Luckily, everything subsided. The pandemic was a very big deal, but for the first 3 months, it was a way bigger deal. And everyone got back to their lifestyles within 6 to 9 months. So we were able to fill the building up and it went up so well. I said, if I can lease up an office building during the pandemic, maybe I can do it even better during more normal times. So went from buying a 5,000 square foot building that I had 4 tenants in to an 8,000 square foot building. And then I got a 16,000 square foot building. And fast forward to today, and we closed a couple of 30,000 square footers. We got a 25,000 square foot office building under contract. And I have not left residential in the dust, but I'm not buying any more residential units at the moment.
Wow. So I'm not an office guy, but to me, vacancy in office is a lot scarier than vacancy in, say, a multifamily or a single family property for a lot of reasons, right? People need a place to live. The market for potential tenants in single family or multifamily is much bigger. You just have a lot more options versus the businesses that you could potentially go after to fill your office vacancies. So how you went through a scary time through the pandemic, didn't necessarily predict it, but who did? And you made it through. You said, if we can be successful leasing offices in the pandemic, then we can do it anytime. But still, can you help us be a little less scared, if you will, if I'm at least me, be a little less scared of vacancy in an office building? How do you approach finding tenants to lease up your office vacancies and that whole process of having enough reserves to cover your debt, to pay the mortgage while there is a vacancy? It's scary. So how do you deal with that fear that I would have?
I will circle back a little bit to when I made the pivot. So at the time I started leasing my first office building, the big fear was exactly everything that you mentioned. Are there really people who are going to come find these spaces? And when they did, I started getting an idea of all the businesses out there that actually need space. And it's not your typical office drop ceiling type place where you have a desk and a bunch of people working on the phone. We have chiropractors and hairstylists and barbers and massage. So you say office, but it's really flexible space. You could do a lot more than just office, even if it's on the second or third level. So after I started marketing in it and filling these places, I contacted a property manager and a broker, and I wanted to see if they can do it any better. So on the second building, they stuck their sign in the yard and they didn't get any calls. And simultaneously, I was trying to hone in on all my marketing skills. And it's everything that you would imagine, from listing on LoopNet to Craigslist to yard signs. But Facebook has been a godsend for our leasing of office space. We are all over Facebook Marketplace, and we have a lot of mom and pop style businesses. So I'm not sure that your 5,000 square foot tech company is going to be on Facebook looking for spots, but your local mom and pops certainly are. So I think about 80% of our vacancies have been filled through Facebook, and that continues to this day.
Wow. Okay. So is there a particular type of messaging on Facebook that has been successful for you for going after those smaller mom and pop office tenants, like things that they look for or what have you, that makes your properties more appealing to them versus the competition?
I really think it has just more to do with being an aggressive landlord who is trying to fill the units versus a non-aggressive broker who has 75 clients and a bunch of units all over the place. I wanted to put them to the test just to see if they were worth their salt, and sure enough, they weren't. But you know, I spend 2 to 3 hours a day leasing my buildings. But simple things that people don't do, you know, we are buying essentially BRRRR office retail buildings. We're buying them vacant or mostly vacant, and that enables us to get them at such a discount that we can make them really nice. So my strategy has always been buy low, rehab them nicely, market the hell out of them. And then when it comes time to negotiate, I try to keep a little under my competition as far as the price per square foot. So nicer buildings at a little less money, and we've had a really good success rate.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about buying right, especially a vacant or nearly vacant office building. That's becomes a problem of, okay, what do you pay for that? And how do you negotiate a deal that works for everybody with the seller on a nearly vacant building? And then to take that even further, how do you approach financing that type of a property? Is that an all cash type of purchase? Walk us through that process of buying a vacant or nearly entirely vacant office building.
Similar to my residential days, it was the BRRRR strategy. I would have to use hard money lenders to come up with the acquisition funds for these. Started doing the office and the numbers got bigger, and I realized the rate that I'm going to pay these hard money lenders is not going to be feasible with a vacant office building. That's when I started like a social media campaign. I said, I need private money. In order to get private money, I'm going to have to get exposed. And I did all the social media. I got my name out there. Slowly but surely, I was able to find debt financing. I wasn't doing any equity splits. And for the most part, I still don't. I pay 10 to 12% debt financing. Part of the first 7 years of my real estate experience was getting a really nice portfolio of single family homes together that has produced some pretty nice cash flow. I got to the point where my portfolio could definitely withhold the zero income from an office acquisition. But even with that said, I'm not using my own money. I'm raising debt. I'm raising debt for the payments. I'm buying well below market with extreme value add. And after I stabilize these buildings, I take them to the bank. My private investors get paid back.
To those debt terms that you approach for the acquisition, is there any form of recourse that you put up on that debt or anything like that could increase the downside risk, if you will, if it doesn't work out?
Some investors want more recourse. Others are okay with just looking at my social media, realizing I know what I'm talking about. And a lot of times it's word of mouth. So if you get a referral with a word of mouth with someone raving about you, that really helps. A perfect stranger can trust you with $100,000 just based on someone else that they trust.
Okay. Wow. So I'd like to also get into the geographic approach that you've taken to this portfolio. So being based in the Cleveland, Ohio area, are you just looking at offices that are in a particular part of Cleveland? How have you thought about diversifying or maybe not diversifying the portfolio from a geographic standpoint? Especially in office, I can see, I would think that being overly concentrated in, say, one part of town, if you will, in office buildings could represent a big risk to your portfolio. So how do you think about that from the geographic standpoint?
So I do say office, but a lot of what we have are strip plazas with office up top, retail on the bottom. So there's a lot of diversification that way. We do have a couple of standalone office buildings with absolutely zero retail. But in terms of the demographics, we don't buy anything in Cleveland proper. It's all in the suburbs. And similar to the residential real estate that I did, the C plus up to B plus markets typically fare best. It's the really nice communities with the really nice office buildings. There's very little value add in those types of areas. And then we still like to stay away from the really bad areas where you can get cheap stuff, but good luck finding tenants for it. So right in the middle is where I found my sweet spot. And again, this is value add stuff. A lot of commercial investors are looking somewhere to park their money. This is hands-on, labor intensive, rehab intensive, tenant intensive, leasing intensive. It takes a lot of work, but when you can turn a $500,000 investment into a $1.5 million investment in a 2-year period, it's worth the effort.
Makes sense. So rehab intensive. Let's see if we can add a little bit of color to that in what an intense rehab looks like in one of these types of office buildings and what types of changes you're having to make. If you have an idea of like maybe cost per square foot or the amount of kind of CapEx that you're doing to rehab the property and get it ready for additional tenants. See, could you add a bit of color to that for us and what the rehabs look like?
So we've had ranges of rehabs, everything from carpet and paint all the way up to taking down the walls and starting over. But we always plan on getting it at a price where we can make significant improvements, whether that is carpet and paint or whether that is completely demoing everything. We need to get it at well below market. And to be honest, the ones where we could get in there and do a little bit of carpet and paint and turn the value around with leasing it up are much more advantageous. But sometimes the deals aren't out there and a big disaster building is. So whatever's out there, we'll tend to take what's next. So I would love to, you know, we just recently did a 30,000 square foot office building, about 50% occupied. We did $80,000 investment, a lot of carpet and paint. We ended up filling that building in about 5 months, 6 months time. In comparison, I bought a 30,000 square foot building that had not been occupied in about 20 years. We rehabbed that for the better part of 18 months, and then it took us another year to fill. So it was about 3 years before we can get that one paid back. In hindsight, maybe I would not have taken that project on, even though it was a great learning experience. But so there, I'm just trying to say there are all a vast amount of difference in the types of buildings we buy and the types of rehabs we do. So it's really difficult to put a number on the build out.
Gotcha. Okay. So you'd mentioned retail earlier. You'd also mentioned about retail on the bottom and offices on the top. And I'd be remiss if we didn't get a bit into that side of things. Folks are always talking about the Amazon effect destroying retail and so on, but there are always things that you need a storefront for, whether it's maybe doctors or haircuts or yoga studios or whatever, you need some kind of physical location. But from your retail type of investing experience, what does your typical tenant look like? And how does that process compare to finding tenants for the office vacancies?
So one of the strategies I've used with office and retail is if we have a big giant space, whether it's first floor, second floor, office, or retail, our goal is to really break that into smaller spaces. There's so many more tenants in the 800 to 2000 square foot arena than there are in the 4000 to 6000 and upwards. And it's great to have one tenant who pays all your bills. It's a lot less work, a lot less back and forth between tenants. But I want to fill these buildings quickly. In order to do that, I want them to be affordable. So we break them up into smaller spaces. We get a lot more mom and pop tenants, hair salons, tattoo artists, photographers, just about everything. Even your standard traditional office tenants who have a software company and they want their people in the office a few days a week.
Okay. So in that vein of like the typical retail tenant, what does that look like for you?
Our first floor retail units are so much easier to rent than our second and third floor office units. They say retail is getting hurt, but I really think that is maybe some of the larger players. We have restaurants. I named some of these, but we just got a tenant the other day who's opening an adult gaming center where they have slot machines and to that effect. And these aren't your class A office buildings that wouldn't want to entertain a business like that. These are like DC class buildings, and that type of business had a ton of money, a big success rate. And he's opening a bunch in the area, and we were happy to have him. It didn't put a black eye on the building at all.
Okay. So let's talk about, and you touched on this very briefly, the actual management side of things and in managing an office property or a retail property as it compares to your experience managing single family properties. Probably a lot less headache to manage an office or a retail property. What does that look like in terms of whether it's from collecting rent or dealing with tenant headaches or complaints or what have you, compared to the single family? What's that all look like?
So when I made the pivot out of residential into commercial, I didn't realize at the time that was a big reason why I was doing it. I've been doing this real estate for about 10 or 11 years. And as you do things longer, you're looking for ways to maybe work less or work more efficiently. And residential real estate is very labor intensive. I've used a comparison before, but say you have a $1 million apartment building with 50 units, or you have a $1 million strip plaza with 5 commercial units. That 50 unit apartment building has 50 toilets, 50 washer dryers, and you get the point. That 5 unit complex, some of them may be on triple net leases and they're responsible for all their own maintenance. So you could just see right there the amount of management and oversight and repairs that are needed for residential compared to commercial, because commercial, you're dealing with a lot more professional people, professional businesses, and it's just overall way less labor intensive in terms of repairs and management. And one of the better things that I didn't realize when I got into it was the eviction process is much simpler. This is probably going to be state to state. I'm here in Ohio. Residential evictions is not that difficult. We can get them out usually within about 45 days. Commercial real estate, if they don't pay their bills, I can put a 3-day notice on their door. And on the 4th day, I can change the locks and I can sell everything inside in order to try to recoup my losses. So I'm not saying I don't vet my tenants, but I am considerably less concerned about who's moving in because it's easy to get them out.
So. Have you had to do any evictions on the office side of things?
We haven't had to do any evictions. We've had people who haven't fulfilled their lease, but we always try to work out a nice smooth transition where, say, we'll give them a little bit of a discount while we try to release their unit. And usually units that are occupied show better because people can see the setup. They can see the entry lobby. They can see the business. When it's completely vacant, everything's out of there, it's a little harder for them to envision. So we've had great success making transitions of people who need to break their lease early into another lease with a different business.
So what do you make of some of the headlines that we've seen about the office market more generally and some of the distressed office properties out there that have been sold at massive discounts in, granted, much more primary or more major markets than where you're investing? There have been some big office towers, flagship properties that have sold for less than they sold for in 2019. And those sales are happening now in 2024. That could signal a pretty significant, or it just is a pretty significant amount of distress in the office markets in some major metros. Are you seeing that same level of distress in the office market in your area with maybe some of your potential acquisitions? It sounds like things are going well for you, but are you seeing that distress in your area amongst maybe some of your competition, if you will?
Yeah, so I've heard the headlines. I watch 10 YouTube videos a day about analysts and Jamie Dimon and just about everyone I can listen to and get their comments on commercial real estate, office space. So you nailed it there, though. The New York, San Francisco, classic high tower. I just heard on the news today that New York has more square feet of vacant office space than every single city has office space in America, with the exception of 5 cities. So they actually have more vacant office space than most cities have of total office space, which was mind-boggling. But you circle back to the Cleveland market, and even further, you get out into the suburban Cleveland market, and it's just a completely different animal. I would be pretty intimidated to buy a 200,000 square foot office building in a downtown metro area, but I'm buying 30,000 square foot buildings in suburbia. And these types of people are usually nearby. They just want somewhere to have their employees go. They want somewhere to go where they don't have to go downtown. And you're filling 6 to 9 vacant units at 30,000 square feet. You're not filling 50 units at 200,000 and up. So it would be intimidating to take on a major office building. But the smaller ones, I think, are performing okay if you have the right management. And by right management, someone who's going to grind their butt off to get these things out there and into people's minds.
Nice. So let's take a moment to talk to Adam of the past, from when you were making that very first office acquisition that you were just going to use basically for yourself and your own business to get yourself out of the house. If you could go back and speak with yourself and give yourself like one piece of knowledge from this experience you've had in scaling up your office portfolio, what would that be? And I want to put some constraints on that. I want to take away the answer of buy as much office as you can, because that's great. Or I want to also take away the answer of, hey, the pandemic's coming, just get ready. From an efficiency standpoint, or more like reusable knowledge that you could pass down to your past self, what would you tell yourself if you could back in 2018-19 timeframe?
It would probably be something similar to what a financial advisor told me a few years prior to that. I had a great accountant, and then I was approached by a financial advisor who said, come with me, we'll do the accounting, we'll give you advice and all that. And I only stayed with him a couple of years, and it was not worth it. But a bit of advice he did give me is similar to what I probably tell my previous self. I went to meet him for a meeting, and I told him where I was. I had just ran carpet here, I'd ran tile there, I was jumping all over to these single family homes. And he said, you're breaking your back doing this single family real estate. And I said, yeah, okay, whatever. Didn't put too much thought into it. But he was a commercial real estate guy himself. And it wasn't until a few years later when I started doing it, I realized I was breaking my back. I love residential real estate. I got really good at it. I made my first niche there. And you can make a lot of money there because you will find tenants. People need a place to live. Rents are always going up. But as I made my pivot, the residential market went crazy. The prices went high. The rates are now high. So it's a little harder to make a footprint in that asset class, but I still love it. I think it's got a ton of ability, but I just like what I'm doing now better.
Nice. Makes a lot of sense. Right now, we're going to take a quick break for our sponsor.
Are you looking for a way to easily track your rental property finances? Check out Stessa. Stessa makes managing real estate investments simple. You can easily keep track of the performance, finances, and the paper trail of your rental properties. Our listeners can get started for free and then upgrade at any time to unlock their more advanced tools. And the even better news is that the upgrade is very affordable and will not break your bank. Smart investors know that tracking the numbers, tracking the money, tracking the finances is what really drives your success. Check out Stessa. It'll make your property finances easier. Just go to escapingwallstreet.com. Scroll down to the Stessa logo and get started for free. Now back to the show.
All right, Adam, I've got three questions I ask every guest on the show. Are you ready?
Yes, I'm ready.
Great. Number one, what's your number one book recommendation?
Last time, I believe I gave you Dale Carnegie, How to Win Friends and Influence People. So I'll give you a different one this time. And it's actually a newer book that was referred to me by a guy who's in sales. And I'm not in sales. Technically, I guess I'm in sales a little bit with marketing. But it's called The Orange Frog. It's a great book, real short read, less than 100 pages. And it's just how to get out of your own way and try not to be what the masses are. And the masses are typically negative and defenseful, and try to take ownership for your life.
Nice. That's a new one. I haven't actually heard of that book before. But The Orange Frog. I like that. Question number two.
You can read it in about an hour.
An hour. Okay, that's good. Short read. Concise. Question number two. Who or what inspires you?
I would go with my commercial real estate mentor. I found him actually through a podcast about 4 years ago. Liked him so much. He started up a mentorship program, and I am still in contact with him today. I look up to him. I've done a lot of my commercial real estate investing because of him.
Nice. Maybe we can get him on the show down the road.
He'd be a great guest.
Nice. We'll have to talk about that. Question number three. Think about 80-year-old Adam. If you could sit down, have a conversation, or maybe a Zoom call with 80-year-old Adam, what advice, feedback, or guidance do you think 80-year-old Adam would give to Adam of today?
It would probably be what I hear a lot of 80-year-olds say on Instagram and YouTube when they're interviewing them and asking them their biggest life regrets. It's slow down, don't get angry, have patience, spend more time with your family. But to be honest, I've seen so many of these videos on people interviewing people who are, you know, near the end and asking their regrets that I've actually started to do a lot of these things. I went from buying 12 single family homes a year to now doing a couple commercial buildings a year. And I've definitely slowed down and realized that life is not all about work. But yeah, it would probably be to take a deep breath, look around you and take a pause.
Nice. Yeah, I like that. I think a lot of folks probably have that realization toward the end of their lives. And Adam, I want to thank you for joining us today and sharing this knowledge about your transition from single family investing to office investing. If folks want to reach out and get in touch, where can they track you down?
You can check out my website, cleinvest.com. And I'm also on Instagram. It's Adam the Investor.
Great. Thank you once again for joining us today. To everybody out there, thank you for tuning in. If you're enjoying the show, please take a moment and leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. I really appreciate that so much, you guys. I see all of your comments, your feedback, your ratings. It gives me a nice little warm and fuzzy feeling every single time. If you are enjoying the show, don't forget to subscribe and catch us here every weekday. Right now, I hope you have a great rest of your day, and we'll talk to you on the next one. Great. Well, thank you once again for joining us today. To everybody out there, thank you for tuning in. If you're enjoying the show, please take a moment and leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Don't forget to subscribe and catch us here every weekday. Right now, I hope you have a great rest of your day, and we'll talk to you on the next one.